I believe in the next 10 years, there's currently a hairdresser in her little salon, 6 seats in a small town right now. She's got a nice business, she's a killer. If she puts a laptop or a camera in her salon and starts to stream the day, literally, I believe that that person is going to become famous and make a lot of money by not playing to the camera, by literally living their life on their core activity.
Attention is the number one asset.
Gary Vaynerchuk, welcome to Money Rehab.
Thanks for having me.
Have we known each other for 100,000 years?
I was thinking about that the other day. I think it was South by Southwest 2006 or 7.
You have amazing memory. By the way, that was the first interactive that they had. Do you remember Mark did the keynote?
I sure do.
We were on like a panel about the internet.
Web 2.0. Like social media hadn't even been coined yet.
That's actually not the first time we met. That's the first time we met in person, but we have an amazing research team, and I want to show you what we found.
Oh my God, I'm excited.
Okay, this was circa 2009.
Love.
It was the first time you were on CNN.com.
Oh my God, I remember this.
And it was wines for Valentine's Day.
Oh my God, I fully remember this. I so remember that. That is so good. Look at us. How cool is that?
I was like 24, maybe 23.
You literally look like you're in high school.
You look like a baby.
Oh my God.
That shirt.
I should have wore it. That's still true. It's still crazy to me how much value there is in wine because there's so much of it and it changes year to year and most people are so undereducated on it. The amount of, it's so funny, the book that I wrote, Day Trading Attention, talks about overpriced and underpriced marketing behavior, and that's, I think I learned it in wine. The amount of people overspending on wine and the amount of deals in wine is pretty extreme.
For you,
I see it.
Just a bit. But this was hilarious. I couldn't believe we found this. So should we?
Your research team deserves a raise. That is really good stuff.
So when you see this guy,
yes.
What do you think?
I think that that dude knew what was happening, which was he intuitively he was, you know, even though I look fairly young there, I'd already been through a real decade of business building, right? That's 10 years into my career, Gary. I'm probably 32 there or something like that. If it's 2009, I'm 34 there. So what I really understood there, look at us, this is so fun. What I really understood there was, oh shit, this is what I saw in 95 and 96 and why I launched winelibrary.com. But at that point, we were a small local liquor store doing Back to Money. Look at that book. That is my first book. You know, everyone thinks Crush It's my first book. So this is 2008 or 7.
Oh, it's
might, yeah, it's earlier. I think it's 2008. Anyway, what that dude knew was, oh, I'm seeing the same movie again. It was only the second time I'd seen that movie. Now I'm probably at 4 times seeing that movie, which is there's a substantial shift going on. And holy crap, this is so cool that I'm doing CNN. But I have a feeling that this Twitter, YouTube, Viddler, all these things at the time, that this is going to become the thing.
Tumblr.
You
were an investor, right?
I was. And so that was a funny time for me because it was the first time I felt like I was sitting on information and I had a little bit that I could do with it in a way that I couldn't do anything the first time. The first time it was like, back to money, we're doing $3.8 million a year in revenue as a liquor store on 10% gross profit. So $380,000 before actual expenses of electricity, payroll. My father was living his American dream by paying to own his own property and building, like many immigrants. So that's what he was focused on and that made sense, and coming to this country with $100, that is a massive accomplishment. I obviously was next gen and had a lot of big dreams. There, back to being an investor in Tumblr and Facebook and Twitter, was the first time I was able to take advantage from a money standpoint, back to the theme of this show, and and knew that I was gonna build a lot of personal brand. And I didn't know that that's what it was called back then. I just knew that I was gonna be known in the wine business, in the wine world, in a way that I could have never dreamed of even 2-3 years earlier, because it's just not how the world worked.
Now you're on your 7th business book, so 8 altogether. You mentioned your dad. As I was reading your book, there is a very early call to action, and you're big on call to actions. So I did it, and I emailed Sasha. I want to just check and make sure. Sasha didn't write me back.
That's very highly likely. Sasha doesn't like to write back because, you know, like many immigrants, Sasha is insecure about his spelling, which I keep telling him and my mom, your son is atrocious at spelling. My team, I love when I send company-wide emails because I always think about the person that's there first week, and now we're like this thing. And like I always wonder if they see the disaster of my grammar and say, am I at the right place or should I quit now? But it is unlikely Sasha will reply to you. But nonetheless, what did you write
Sasha?
Him?
Sasha? Here.
Oh, it's long.
I didn't fuck around, Gary.
That's very sweet.
What do you think?
I think you're so sweet. It's going to make his day.
So I'm first generation American too.
Yes.
And I remember that spelling insecurity, like when I was applying to colleges, I had to figure out for the first time. Do you think a lot of your hustle comes from not just like you being here, but this immigrant mentality that we all share, no matter where your parents came from?
Yeah, I think like, you know, for the people that are listening, and I think the immigrant mentality slang for like some sort of mix of ambition and really almost like a form of lack of complaining and or a mix of gratitude. There is incredible advantages of being an immigrant in a place of opportunity like America. And what I mean by that is there are plenty of seventh generation Americans listening right now that have full accountability, don't complain, tremendous ambition, incredible tenacity. But there's one very big truth in human life, which is it's hard to be hungry when you're fed. And you know, for me, it's very clear, it's not hard to analyze. When I was 12 and I wanted things, and I had already at the age of 12 entered the zone where my mother felt that she didn't need to buy things for me, that if I wanted them, I should go get it. You can imagine selling lemonade or baseball cards or whatever I had to do. Shoveling snow was a big activity of mine. Washing cars was a big activity of mine. May she rest in peace. I lost a friend that I grew up with, Marissa Bird. Makes me a little emotional, but like, we fucking, Robbie Turnick, I know you're watching too right now. Andy Greco, my little sister Liz. We fucking hoses on our, like real hoses. Not like, you know, back when they made them well, like wrapped on our shoulders. Like bucket of water, like we grinded because we grew up in an environment where like mommy and daddy were not gonna buy you things at Toys R Us. Like if we wanted bazooka from Krausers, like we needed to find that 5 cents, and it, of course, that became a humongous advantage.
And how did that change the way you dealt with money? Like my family just used cash. I also have found that regardless of where your family's from, nobody used the dishwasher. Did you use the dishwasher?
We didn't even have one. Like, we grew up very, like, just to remind everybody, because I know there's probably a lot of people here watching that don't have a lot of context on me. Like, I was born in the Soviet Union. When we moved to Queens to immigrate to America, we lived in a studio apartment with multiple family members, 5, 6, 7, depending on what was going on, because there was 3 studios. Like, we were really poor. Not like, we weren't lower. Like a lot of people like talk about, oh, I grew up humbly, and what they're saying, thank God, this is a wonderful thing. We're in a prosperous country. They mean they grew up middle class. Like they didn't have a BMW. Like we grew up, like now to my dad's credit, we weren't dirt poor for very long. We were dirt poor, and then we moved to Dover in like a little bit better situation. And then I mainly grew up in a townhouse in Edison, New Jersey, which was a blue collar, lower middle class neighborhood. And so, we didn't have a dishwasher. Like, I remember thinking a dishwasher was like, that was status. I remember thinking, as old as 14 years old, which would be 1989, I remember thinking that if you had a BMW or a Mercedes, that would be equivalent to the way we look at the Kardashians today. Like, private plane, yachts, Elon Musk, Bezos. Like, to me, if you had a Mercedes or a BMW, you were filthy, filthy rich. So my relationship with money, though, is very fascinating in hindsight, which I think, and you'll probably know this better than I, so I'm almost asking you this question. I got really lucky and fortunate that I don't have a relationship with money where I view it as validation. I don't hoard it. I definitely don't weaponize it. I view it as a byproduct of the thing I really love, which is the game.
Winning.
But I also love losing.
Tell me more.
Well, I think entrepreneurship's interesting to me. Like, I think about this a lot. I love winning, but I equally get great joy in losing. Another great podcast like yours I did, where I finally broke it down, was Steve Bartlett's podcast. I got a lot of emails about this. I talked about this thing that happens to me. It actually just happened a couple weeks ago, where I'm still at 48, play pickup basketball. And you shoot for teams. And sometimes if you shoot for teams, instead of just mixing up teams, if there's 10 guys there, and you're like, okay, let's make this kind of even, you're tall, you guys split, you're good, you stink, like, you know, which is common. We always shoot for teams. And sometimes when you shoot for teams, the teams are obnoxiously lopsided. And I especially get excited when my team is much worse. And I really weirdly like when we lose the first game, 11-2. Something chemically triggers into me where I get really excited about it. It's kind of like it's nothing like too wild other than like, can we have the intestinal fortitude? Can we have the chemistry amongst ourselves? Can we be clever or figure something out to somehow now win the next game? And sometimes the teams are very lopsided. You get your ass kicked again and I just talked about in this podcast like how I get enjoyment out of that. And it's similar to business. I don't get devastated when agendas, investments, concepts, strategies, or even companies I start fail. I view it as that's the price of admission. I don't feel entitled that because I have been historically successful, that I'm allowed to be successful in the next thing I do. And weirdly, I like when I fail because it allows me to talk to myself of like this fun relationship of like, see big shot? Like, this fucking game doesn't give a fuck about you. This is real merit shit. And you weren't good enough. I like that. It's kind of like the podcast ratings. I've been doing it for a long time and it ebbs and flows, right? When I heard there was an opportunity to do the show with you, I was pumped because we hadn't seen each other in a while. And then, you know, during that process, I was like, oh, and I got to see how well this show's doing. And that makes me so happy for you. What I liked about that was when I looked at it, that was the first time I'd looked in a long time. And I got to see a lot of people that have been doing it for a long time and a lot of people that are emerging. And you see, and you know this because you do this for a living, over the last 10 years, there's been like just a lot of ebbs and flows. Like there was multiple years where my podcast was in the top 100 consistently overall. That is not where I am now. And I think I deserve that because I know that I'm not putting everything into my podcast right now because I'm putting it into other things. I like that. I feel like you do deserve to be where you are in your life because you're doing it. And I don't know, I'm obsessed with merit. That's why I love sports. Like you can talk anything you want, but they're gonna play tonight, a tennis match is gonna happen, a basketball game is gonna happen, and everybody can talk, but the game's gonna play out and the game's gonna be the game. And business is the closest thing to that. I like that there's merit in it. And I don't want to only like the game for what I get out of it. I want to love the game for the game. And then because that's my obsession, yes, I got fortunate. My passion wasn't painting, it wasn't singing, it wasn't gardening or golfing. My passion was entrepreneurship. The byproduct, if you're good at that, is there is economic upside. No different, by the way, than if you're a remarkable athlete or actress or things of that nature. But I find a lot of people that grow up with little become overly obsessive and have a very unhealthy relationship with money. They use it as a makeup or a band-aid to close up feelings that they had from that era. I grew up in a very fortunate environment, which was we didn't have a lot of money, but I was happy all the time because my mother was such a supernova. So I was one of those lucky people who learned that money isn't the antidote to happiness. And I actually believe the people that are most happy in the world are the ones who don't grow up with a lot and grew up with extreme happiness, because they're taught from day one there is no correlation to happiness and money, and I'm very grateful for that.
Well, thank you for the kind words for the show.
I've always thought
legit.
I've always thought from that moment to this second and every moment in between, because I love watching the game, the world, people, things. You're very tenacious, you're very talented. It always made sense to me why you would have wins.
I got you. And you're just a good dude. You answer all your emails. I called you when I was launching Rich Bitch. That was my first book 10 years ago. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. And you were on, I don't know, number three at that point. And you said to me, you were so, so generous with your time. I came in New York and you said, do podcasts. And at that time, I was like, okay. And I told my publishers and they're like, where do you find podcasts?
It was a different era.
And here we are, like a podcast network later. And you were absolutely right. That was where the conversion was happening. You also told me to write a list of everybody I knew, go off the grid for 2 weeks, contact them, right?
The reason I looked at Dustin is it is still advice I give to anyone who's selling books. If you're selling books, you've lived a life where you've done a lot of good things for a lot of people. And asking is okay as long as you don't judge them if they don't deliver.
Hmm.
The reason people struggle with my advice in selling books is their feelings get hurt when someone doesn't buy a bunch when they know they've done great by them. Mm-hmm. I've had some extreme, I mean, I have one example that I will never forget to the day I die. And it does not bother me one bit, but I use it all the time and I'll use it right now because it's an opportunity to teach people a lesson of what happens when you have expectations and how happy you can be if you don't. So you're right. When someone's selling a book, I really think it's a good idea to go off the grid for a week, which is nice, you get some rest before you go hard. It's a lot easier to just lay on the beach and go literally A through Z in your phone and your inbox and say, hey, this means something to me. I've gone really serious about this. I feel proud of it. It would mean the world to me if you could buy a bunch. One or a bunch.
Or something else, right? Or be really specific, like can you send out this tweet, whatever platform, maybe they have more people or...
But it's funny, I believe that I'm saying this out loud, so I expect friends to reach out to me in the future, I think it's more important, I think I make a bigger impact, and I have a very big platform. I still believe me buying 300 books for a friend that I really know, that really asked, and put them in the lobbies of all 10 of our VaynerX offices, is going to sell more books potentially than a single tweet of like, hey, Johnny's book is awesome, or Sally's book is awesome. Now, it could be the other way, but like really actually asking. The problem is, when I used to tell that advice, and I've been telling it for a long time, I didn't realize how many people were so grounded in insecurity, and envy, and resentment. Early on, the first 3 or 4 people that I told to do that, they would reach out to me and be like, this was horrible. I was like, what happened? They're like, well, I did get on the news, like, it did work. But like, now I'm really mad at Rick. And I'm like, why? Well, Rick didn't buy anything and I've been so nice to Rick. And I was like, and it made me think about the most impactful story I have on this, which is I asked someone who I reopened, meaning an investment was closed, it was done. I went to bat for this person, to the founder, to reopen the round and let them put $50,000 in, or $100,000, I don't remember, an investment. The company went on to have a massive exit. This person made heavy 8 figures. And when I went and asked for a book buy, they bought none and ghosted me. And I remember that being a really exciting moment for me because it was when I was able to call my bluff on myself. I genuinely mean what I'm about to say. I've continued to have a relationship with this person, like, you know, later on. I genuinely don't judge the person because my brain goes to, maybe they were busy. By the way, I asked 4 times because I knew I made this person lots of money. I was like, this guy can buy 500 copies, you know, like I really knew. I'm so grateful and thankful for my parenting, my DNA, my circumstance. The fact that I have no real feelings against that. I just only know how to deploy optimistic compassion, right? Maybe he was in a bad place. Maybe, I don't know. Who am I to judge? And don't forget, here's the big key to this, Nicole, and I hope this lands for people. I was asking. When you ask, You're not allowed to judge.
But it's vulnerable.
Well, but here's my thing. When you're asking, you're the one asking. When people get mad at people for not reciprocating their ask, I remind them all, I'm like, you're fucking asking.
Like, don't look a gift horse in the mouth or whatever the saying is.
I just believe there's something very powerful around expectation. If you're able to get into a place where you're just not expecting, you only control yourself. And so anyway, I don't know how we got there, but that's, oh, your book, yes. I think.
You were pissed.
I'm honestly, I'm being dead serious with you. When I realized, oh my God, this person's not gonna buy it, I was in order, baffled, because he just made tens of millions of dollars. B, I'm being just very vulnerable and transparent. Baffled, B, quickly to, hope he's okay. To see, oh, I really don't give a shit about this. This is epic. I actually eat my own dog food. I talk about no expectation. I literally know every detail about what's happening here, and I'm not that upset about it. Fuck it, let's move on.
It's kind of like real life, jab, jab, jab.
Right
hook. Jabs are four jabs.
Jab, 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 right hook. Ironically,
it's like give, give, give.
By the way, day trading attention was originally, literally up until the final hour, called jab, 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 left hook. It's literally the follow-up to that book.
Part two,
but it got so nerdy, and it's the most detailed marketing book I've put out, that it just felt like it was different. It was more of what now I realize I've been doing for 20 years, which is day trading attention.
And what does that mean? First of all, I love the day trading part, obviously.
Yes.
I would love to know what long-term attention investing is. But explain to me what the concept of day trading attention.
Well, listen to what just happened in the meta right before this part. You told the audience in our relationship through the years, I've had an ability to be like, I think this is happening. I think this is happening. And obviously, you also know, because you've been in the game, there's many examples of that with me, whether it's YouTube or Twitter or TikTok, or just a lot. It's been the story of my life. Day trading attention is the core asset in the world is attention. For governments, for parents, for businesses, for media companies, it's attention. And the history of the world, attention platform distribution evolves. So, if you wanted to sell something way back when, you probably had to draw something in a cave, and other cavemen walked by it and were like, I need that club, you know? And then obviously newspaper and radio, right? I think a lot about that. I study newspaper and radio transition to television a lot, and have a lot in the last 20 years. I think a lot about this classic political story where JFK loses the debate on radio to Nixon, but wins the debate on television, which was a new medium. He goes on to win the election.
He's sweating.
Correct. Nixon looked like crap. JFK was fucking
a fucking stud.
And so, and then I was also born in the Soviet Union, so I'm growing up in the 80s during the Cold War, the end of it, and I'm thinking about propaganda, and I've always been fascinated by even weird things like coup d'etats, like when you're overthrowing a government, why they would always go to the newspaper and radio station at the same time they would go after the palace. Somewhere at a very young age, I understood communication mattered. So, and then obviously I was very affected by it. I had a small family liquor store business that I was coming into that I was very, 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 and I mean very, hyper-focused on building a very big business for my parents. And I was like, I'm gonna do this for a while and then I'll do my own thing. And I got very fortunate. The internet was just emerging. So all of a sudden I launched winelibrary.com in 1997. There's not a liquor store that has a website in America. There's literally three or four at the time. There was three or four of us. And I watched our family business go from a $3 to a $40 million business in a nanosecond, AKA 5 years, with no money. I didn't raise VC. We didn't even have a credit line on the business. This was all using its own cash flow. And I did that through email marketing while every other wine store in the country was doing catalogs. So day trading attention. I was getting attention in 1997 and 98 and 99 from people that worked on Wall Street that were early to email, signing them up and sending them a daily email about Opus One and Chateau Lafite. And I was outflanking the biggest stores in the country at the time, Zaki's and Sam's and K&L out here in California, these iconic wine stores that I looked up to as a teenager, that I would used to buy the New York Times when I was 15, the Wednesday dining in section, and look at their full page ads. One day I'm gonna be like them. They're spending 4 to 6 months making catalogs, spending lots of money making the catalogs. So they were spending more money and they were slower than I was. I was spending no money on email or the distribution, and I was doing it daily. So I was getting to the customers, the biggest wine customers in the country, and selling them Insignia and Camus and Silver Oak and Chateau Lafite. And then 2 months later, they would get a catalog for Morel's or Sherry Lehman's with that same stuff for more expensive, and they'd already bought it for me. And so I was able to outflank the entire industry with a new medium, which was email, and having a website. And then later when we met, that was starting to happen because I saw this thing called YouTube, and a couple months after it came out, I started a wine show, right? And then obviously social.
We changed the name, right, of the store?
Yes, the store was originally called Shoppers Discount Liquors, and then we rebranded it to Wine Library. And so I was very affected by day trading attention, which I define as, right this second as we sit here, there is overpriced and underpriced ways to get attention. You could run a Super Bowl ad for this podcast. It would cost you $20 million between the media, the production. CBS would force you to buy other inventory in their ecosystem that is bullshit inventory. It might cost you more than that. So that would be a bad idea. Even though the Super Bowl is my favorite ad.
You say, though, in your book that it's still undervalued.
I agree with that.
With all those millions.
I agree with that.
Remnant.
I agree with that. And I think if you're Nike or Coca-Cola, then that is going to be a good idea because their marketing budgets are enormous. The only reason that's not a good idea for you is my intuition is you're not spending $20 million a year promoting this.
Not yet.
That's right. And so, but if you are spending $1,000 or $100,000 or $500,000, you want to spend it as wisely as possible, right? And so to me, right as we sit here and record today, the number one thing that has happened in marketing is that organic reach in social has changed in the last couple years compared to what we grew up with. When we were growing up with social media, it was more like email marketing. You would get as many people to follow you as possible, and then when you would post, a percentage of them would see it. Today, one clip from this show has the ability to get 10 million views on TikTok, and another clip from this exact show might get 4,000. The creative is the distribution now with these algorithms, and that is a substantial, massive, massive land grab that I want people to know about. And there's a million others, whether it's influencer marketing or Hulu pre-roll. Something you should be doing is running ads of video of this on what is now modern television. You can buy Hulu ads now for if you have $100. And if you put that in front of other financial content, that's awareness, just like pre-roll YouTube has been established. So these are all the things running through my mind all the time.
What is undervalued and what's overvalued right now? Because when you were also promoting Wine Library, you bought AdWords. And
yes.
You thought that they were overvalued, but they were really undervalued at the time.
The clarity on that, let me jump in, is I bought them so cheap, like day they came out at 5 and 10 cents a click, that when they went up a year or two later to like 40 and 50 because other people were doing it, cents, 40 and 50 cents, I was like, oh, it's over. Right, because I was like, damn, it used to be so cheap. I didn't really know at the time what CAC and LTV was. I didn't think in terms or never thought about customer acquisition versus lifetime value. I inherently did. I was like, if I invest in my business and we're good at what we do, we'll keep these customers. It'll work out in the long term. But I didn't have the math down yet. So to your point, what you're referencing is, I wish that I spent more money on Google AdWords in 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5. It was that I was so goddamn early that I got confused and tricked my own self that it was like, oh, it's over now. Like, I should have still been buying those things at 50 cents a dollar, even $2, because they were worth it to the business. They were just $2. Like, when you bought the word wine for 10 cents on Google and were the first result, you can imagine when that word went to $16 a couple years later per click, you were like, fuck this shit. What I didn't know yet was it was still worth for my company to pay $16 because the client was worth more.
Or that could go up to $100. Like, you don't know
Correct.
Where you are in the
Correct.
Chart. And so I think people think of TikTok right now and say, like, I've missed it. It's too late. Like, I can't put my stake in the ground anymore. In the same way as, like, you know, maybe you thought that you were at the peak of AdWords, but it was just in the middle. You don't know until you zoom out.
Correct. And then there's a game of best. There's not only is it underpriced, but then are you good at the creative? So is it harder to quote unquote go viral on TikTok today than it was 4 years ago when I was yelling about it on every platform?
Yelling. I know. It was pre-pandemic and you wanted everybody to go.
It was just
physically first. Yeah.
That's right. It had already happened. So I knew, like, the thing that has worked for me is I don't predict because I want to keep good reputation. Anytime I'm yelling about something, it has happened. I'm just there early enough that it doesn't feel like it's happened. But to your point, like, what's really fascinating now that everyone needs to hear is you've missed nothing. Today, somebody will start a YouTube channel. YouTube has been rocking and rolling since 2005, right? For the last 19 years. Today, as we're doing this right now, somebody will start a YouTube channel and they will go on to fucking crush it because they were better. That'd be like saying, well, there was no room for Billie Eilish because Madonna and Cyndi Lauper and Whitney Houston were pop stars and all the pop star opportunities are done. It's a merit-based game on the creative. And so no medium, not podcasting, not YouTube, not Twitter, not Facebook, every one of them is fertile ground for best, but best takes creativity once things get overpopulated. What skill set creatively it took to go crazy on TikTok 4 years ago, today is the mundane. That doesn't mean you have to be crazy. It means that you have to provide something new and different that has depth. The other thing I wrote back to, we're giving flowers here. The other thing that I always thought was going to work for you was the depth of what you were talking about. You were talking about substantive stuff. The stuff you were saying was right. Financial literacy continues on this day, as we sit here, to be still way underpenetrated from what I wish the world knew. So the other thing that people need to hear that I think has been very substantial for both of us is you can have sizzle, and we both have sizzle, that matters, charisma, ability, all character, that happened. But if you do not have steak, you have no chance of longevity. Back to that South by Southwest, I remember the keynote I gave that year. I remember, because I used to read every single tweet after every talk I gave. And I remember many people during that era thinking that I'd be gone in a year or two because they thought my over-the-topness was just shticky and like all sizzle, no steak. And I remember enjoying that back to like, because I knew that, no, I'm doing this forever. Like I'm a real businessman. Like I think at that point already, I'd already accomplished things. I wasn't guessing. Like I knew I had the work ethic and the talent. I really think that people need to hear, like, if you're thinking about starting a podcast or you think you missed TikTok or you want to do a YouTube channel, like, there's nothing stopping you. Do I believe that the next big platform that comes out, if you move fastest on it, that you'll get even more upside if you're good? Of course. It's just supply and demand of attention. But there's never a bad time to go on a big platform if you're good enough.
Well, I say that about investing, too. Like, you're never as young as you are today. Some people say they're too old. Today is as good a day as any.
Or you miss something, right? To that same point, if you missed investing in a good business and you're like, damn, I should have bought it at $18 a share. Now it's 42. Well, guess what? If it's actually a good business. I mean, I remember people telling me that they missed out on Apple stock in 2011. Really? Really? Like, right? You know, right? I mean, Facebook, I invested in Facebook 40 years before the IPO. I've never sold a share. It opened at 42 and went to 19. A lot of the people that worked at Facebook at the time at the 6 month lockout sold at 19. It's 500.
That's weird because you don't know where you are in that chart.
That part.
And what are you yelling about now? Rich?
I do love live streaming, but I'm yelling about Twitch for a different reason. I don't need to yell about Twitch. Twitch has clearly long established that it's important. Ninja popped on Twitch 7-8 years ago. This is nothing new. Clicks, Aiden Ross, all this stuff. And I know Aiden's on Kick or something, but streamers have won. What I'm yelling about with live streaming is I see something really interesting. I think there's a new genre coming that's gonna blow people away, which is what I will call the mundane. People that are streaming, almost like an ASMR of something, like I said something the other day, I'll say it again, I believe I'll use an example. I believe in the next 10 years, there's currently a hairdresser in her little salon, six seats in a small town right now. She's got a nice business, she's a killer. I admire that entrepreneur a lot. The fact that she is on the, maybe she's listening right now. If she puts a laptop or a camera in her salon and starts to stream the day, literally, I believe that that person is going to become famous and make a lot of money by not playing to the camera, by literally living their life on their core activity.
Like Truman Show style.
That's right. Now, I also used an analogy in a recent podcast that I'm really excited about. I believe a stay-at-home mom and dad is gonna stream their 6 a.m. to 8:30 of cooking, cleaning up the kitchen, and getting the family ready for the day, that will be the stream, and that person will go on to make 7 figures. What I wrote about in Crush It, which has come to be true, I didn't call it influencers, that humans would be able to make money on what they were passionate about, I believe is about to happen with streaming. That I am encouraging people that are listening right now that if you can stream the mundane, I used another analogy. If you mow your massive lawn for 3 hours, there's going to be a big movement in the next 3 to 4 years where live streaming of what seemingly is not interesting, because don't forget, you were there. You remember what everyone said about Twitter. Everyone was like, I'll never forget this. When Twitter, when I was yelling in 2006 and 7 about Twitter, and when we're at these kind of conferences, everyone was like, this is so stupid. Who gives a shit if you're having a pizza? Nobody cares that you're walking the dog. And I remember in a Q&A session at South By, somebody went really hard at me, said, this is actually idiotic. And she said, Gary, you seem like, something was kind of like clever in how she posed it. You seem like a smart guy. Do you actually, like, who gives a shit about what you're having for dinner? And my answer was everyone. And the whole, I remember the oxygen coming out of the room. Like that moment, you know, where you're just like, a mic drop. And it was fun because half the room was like, couldn't like comprehend what I was saying. And I just remember looking at certain eyes and energy, and obviously people I talked to after I got off stage. It clicked for a lot of people. My belief at the time was what has now transpired. It's how human communication works. And when somebody was listening right now, probably breathing to themselves while they're on the treadmill or driving listening right now or walking their dog, and hearing me saying that I think somebody who owns a small salon will make millions of dollars through ad revenue, subscriptions and merch, and books and speaking, after she accomplishes what I'm saying, that someone's gonna make millions of dollars a year only by live streaming what she's doing Monday through Sunday now, which is just running her business. I think people struggle with that leap, but it's fucking crystal clear to me.
So how would you start doing that?
You know, there's only one issue at hand in this entire conversation, which is it okay for privacy of the other people that happen to cross paths with what you're doing? So if you're a person that works at home all day, a painter, if you fucking paint, put a fucking camera and go live and paint. Obviously for the salon woman, the thing that's a concern that everyone's gonna have to figure out is, you know, a salon is like a therapy session. So if she's streaming her day and a woman's coming in and she's doing what she normally does with this salon person who's been her salon, you know, hairstylist for 11 years, that's now her therapist. If she's now complaining about her husband to that person, obviously that's live on the internet, that could cause some, so a lot of people are listening, you're gonna have to figure out the privacy thing. Two things on that. One, a lot of people are gonna be fine with it. They'll adjust. They're like, I can't talk about shit about my husband here because it's being filmed. Number two, a lot of people are doing solo life. But again, I'm gonna say it nice and slow. I don't think a lot of, I'll give you one. One of the biggest, most important, really admirable jobs, in my opinion, of when people come to first world countries is they clean homes. A lot of immigrants do that, right? It's something you can control. You can do that job without speaking English or Chinese or whatever place you're going to. Man, obviously, again, very challenging. I listen to this, I'm an immigrant, I'm like, I'm gonna do this. Tough to live stream from the home that you're cleaning for someone because you're showing someone else's home. But do I believe that if you were able to get over that hump, which might be too surmountable in this scenario, that somebody could go from getting paid some sort of hourly wage there to becoming famous. Yes, I do. And I think that that's the next frontier of what's going
to
happen.
Well, it's almost like a boomerang, though, because didn't Lonely Girl try to do this?
Well, what Lonely Girl was, and I was there on early YouTube, and I'll never forget when that popped. Lonely Girl was weird because it was a show, but we didn't know for the first couple weeks if it was real or not. So it was like Blair Witch, reality, real world. They did such a good job, that company, because you thought she was a real person. Because that was the days of Zay Frank, remember? And Renetto, and like, and Rocket Boom. And that was just a very, I mean, first, for everybody's listening, first 2 years of YouTube was bananas. It was, yeah, it was like 90% pirated content, right, from the late night shows and The Simpsons, and then a bunch of fucking people like me all trying to figure out, like, this might be something.
But I guess from a business owner's perspective, this is what I struggle with. And I remember being on CNBC, we'd have analysts come on who were always available to come on TV. And we were like, if you're always available to come on TV, like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, are you really a big fund manager? Because, like, how do you have time to leave whatever you're doing and come on TV? And I think about the same thing with social, because I'm running a business, and so I'm supposed to be on all the time. But, like, I'm knee-deep running a business. And so how...
Well, it's why I suck at streaming. Right now, my streaming, because I always want to, if I'm going to talk the way I'm talking right now, I need to taste. I'm not talking from thesis or hypothesis or professor land. I'm streaming my office right now. My problem is I'm in such operations mode between VFriends and VaynerX right now that my day-to-day is so goddamn boring. I'm literally sitting at my desk, literally doing 12 straight hours every minute on minute of meetings. I'm operating. And the entire stream is on mute because the meetings I'm having are sensitive information. And so I unmute for a second, they're like, thanks for hanging out, guys. But like, so to answer your question, a couple things. One, there's ways to be clever. When I started realizing that I wanted to vlog, and I was like, oh, Casey Neistat, that's so amazing. But I was like, I can't do that. So I took, and you probably remember this, I took a crazy step and hired D-Rock, right? And that became a term, like, I need a D-Rock. Like, that was very early, I was one of the first people that had a human being following me around 24/7.
I remember before that, didn't you have a human trainer following you around and taking
Yes, that was the same time. That's exactly right.
And first class.
I literally started vlogging, D-Rock following me, and Mike Vacanti, who I worked out with this morning, virtually. That was 10 years ago when I started getting serious about my health. It happened the same time. I had two human beings following me around. One was filming me, and one was making sure that I wasn't putting non-needed carbs into my fucking body.
So explain to me, like, let's double click and take people behind the scenes of this operation. So you're live streaming on mute. How does that look? Where are you streaming? How is it working? Tell me about
your... twitch.tv/GaryVee. Everyone can go see it. It's literally a camera. I mean, I'm looking at the camera of us right now. There's a camera. I'm living my life. Again, I'm not doing it well. I'm doing it to really taste it, right? I think that there's, in Twitch, you can raid someone's channel. That means when you're done live streaming, you can send all your viewers to someone else. The team found this woman. Is it the pizza lady that we send? Is that a husband and wife, or what's their scene?
Just boyfriend.
And they have a pizza shop.
Yeah, in Rochester.
In Rochester, New York. And they're just like, there's a camera just of them behind, like the kind of security camera, right? Like you just see them making pizzas all day. We've sent some of our audience there, so I know the team likes her stuff and him, and like it's what everyone is listening to is thinking, it's that.
So but then how do you run a business successfully and also make sure you're doing content all the time? Because you're like, content.
Well,
content,
I was going to answer why those analysts were probably either one of two extremes. Either very smart or what you think, which is faking the funk, right? Anybody, this goes back to the premise of the book. If you're one of the top hedge fund operators, managers, or whoever you had in private equity people or public CEOs, they were extracting the attention from CNBC. You could listen, I am very busy, but if I am given the opportunity to have 30 or 40 minutes or 17 minutes, especially with Zoom, 10 minutes, that I allocate to that level of awareness of what I'm doing, that's ROI positive. So CNBC is a no-brainer. The ones I'm more skeptical about is like they're on every little thing that has like 19 viewers, but even that they might be smart about. One of the main reasons I do podcasts is A, for the attention of the audience, which is happening right now, B, for the recordings of it for my own content. I like doing two for ones. You know, I love public speaking because I enjoy it, right? It's lucrative for me, but luckily for me, it's become not ROI positive to the amount of time that I need to allocate for it. One of the main reasons I still do it, there's only two reasons I still do it. I genuinely enjoy it, and I want to do it occasionally. It's still fun for me. And two, I need content. I have a problem. To your point, I'm so operating right now that I don't have enough content. And so I need to actually allocate time for podcasts or keynotes or other things just to have content creation, because my life is my production facility.
I love a twofer.
I love a twofer.
I love a deal. So what does that look like? And what about the people that are maybe faking the funk on social media that are like, I'm making millions of dollars in one day and this and that?
Well, you know that. Like,
I mean, I think if you're rich, you don't have to say you're rich. But it's become more of a trend.
Look, honestly, I don't even think about that, because this goes back to what we talked about earlier. That just plays itself out. You and I have been around the block at this point a little bit. We've seen people come and go. And so, like, you know, look, as long as no one's massively hurting someone, you know, like really bad stuff, then it just becomes like, I have no feelings towards anything that someone's doing that might be faking the funk. Because they're, you know, from my perspective, you know, honestly, I go to compassion. I'm like, I hope they get into a good place where they don't have to do it this way.
Hmm. So explain to me who's on the team now.
Meaning,
what's
from
happening? Like, for this twofer, what are we doing?
Dustin's recording. We have about a 25-person team at this point, I think. Bunch of international people. The content goes into a hub, and we go through the content. Now more than ever, starting to use AI tools to go through the content and pick out the moments that we think have validity or upside to be meaningful short form content, and away we go. And I distribute through every platform. I think what's unique about me still is there's not a lot of people who go coast to coast from Snapchat to LinkedIn and everything in between. I post on every single platform at scale every day. Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube Shorts, TikTok, Instagram, all of them, Twitter, like all of them.
And you have that distribution plan that goes out automatically, somebody's doing it, what tools are you using, is it on Asana, what kind of AI, yes?
Are we just switching from Asana? Yeah, I think so. Everything you just said, and again, like literally human beings with tools, project management tools, editing tools, whether it's CapCut or Adobe or whatever it is. Honestly, I'm not even close enough to it anymore, because it's really, those things are agnostic. What the key is creating scenarios where you can capture content and then putting as much talent or science against the ability to extract those individual creative pieces. And then what I wrote about in the book, this concept of PAC, what I call PAC, platforms and culture. Right, so one of the reasons I love, let's go very nerdy and deep into details. One of the reasons I love the greens, this is something you could crush. I apologize, I'm not sure if you're doing this or not. Green screens, you would crush green screens.
It would take so long.
No, it doesn't, that's so weird you say that, because green screens is one of the biggest reasons I do mine on Instagram, but let me rephrase. I reacted the way I reacted because it's one of the few things that I can do fast. Get a headline of something I have an opinion on, put it in the green screen filter, flip the camera, look at it, speak my piece for 60 to 90 seconds, and send it to the team with copy, and we're done.
I see, but not like several cuts.
Correct, correct, show. Got it. If you're talking about like the Alex Earl, like that, that's different. That's I don't even know what the proper terminology for those stop cuts, which is amazing. I've actually been talking shit for 6 months with my team. I've been wanting to do a show like that with those hard cuts called Winding Down, where like I do my recap of the day while reviewing a bottle of wine. Clever name, right? But to your point that it's hard, I've been talking shit, I'm like, I'm gonna do it. And I never do it, because it is, but you know, especially for me, after a 10, 11, 13 hour day, to like then go and do another.
That's how I feel.
That's hard. Green screen is different. Green screen is an image or a video that you get that runs in the background of you being at the forefront of, right? A green screen. Like, and for me, I actually use a lot of mainstream media headlines and talk over it. That's been huge. I was about to say why that's huge, because that hits on the C in PAC. PAC stands for platforms and culture. Culture is pop culture, and timely pop culture matters, right? And so if you can speak on social commentating on what's going on, and then if you understand platforms, is a carousel ad better than a Reels? Should you post in text? Should you do, you know, Instagram over TikTok? Or the answer is always gonna be both, but how does YouTube Shorts act differently than Facebook Reels? Like, there's a lot of science to this.
And there's a lot of AI that's changing the game. Like, what are you guys using? Is it Opus or Limbo? Like, can you give us some nerdy blocking and tackling?
You know what's funny? I don't think we've fully, like, we're just onboarding all, I'm thinking about editing tools, all the things you just brought up, or ChatGPT or things of that nature, are Midjourney and things of that nature. They're supporting tools for thinking. We haven't really fully, like, we're on. One of the big things I worried about, and the reason we have been slow to using all of them, was the terms of service. A lot of these AI companies were very spooky to me, because if we ingested our content, it wasn't clear if they could use it for the overall platform, which, as you can imagine, was something I needed to think through. By the way, on the record, it's not like I'm scared of that, because I think it's an inevitable outcome. I have unlimited content on the internet, so anyone can take it, ingest it into an AI tool and think like me or do me. I get all that. That doesn't scare me. It was more of when the laws are written by America, the EU, the world is gonna have to address this issue. When it's written, I just wanted to make sure that it's one thing if someone went on the internet and took my stuff and did it. If I self-deposited it in, I wanted to know the TOS. We're finally in place where it seems like the AI tools are starting to write terms of services where they say, and we have no rights to this. You can use our tool, but it's not like we can ingest all that information and do something with it.
So what is scaring you with AI?
The same thing that scares me with anything in life. Nothing scares me per se, but the thing that everybody should always be vigilant on is, what don't we know, right? That's all. Like, you know, the thing that scares me with AI is the same thing that scares me with sugar. There was a time when the world didn't understand sugar completely. Now, there's a lot of science and understanding that a lot of sugar leads to dementia or Alzheimer's or a lot of other things we don't want to happen. I'm not overtly scared of the robots killing our children, but I don't eliminate it as a possibility. Anything can happen. I just don't demonize new technologies. I look at the optimism. I don't think about all the jobs that AI is going to take out. I think about all the jobs that AI is going to create. When everyone cried about the car being invented, which was something people cried about, they said, look at all these people in the horse business that are gonna go out of business. This is real stuff. I mean, there was, God, I hate this. I always promise myself, don't forget the number, because then you can use it, and I can't remember it, so I'm not gonna make it up. There was a shocking amount of people in the United States of America whose jobs were directly correlated to horse shit. I'm being dead serious. The amount of people in Manhattan, Chicago, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Baltimore, that's job in life was to go around the city and clean up horse shit, because horses is how we moved around. There was articles written about, this car is terrible, what are all these people going to do? The tractor, when the tractor was invented, Nicole, the amount of people that worked on farms in this country and this world was insane. It put them all out of business. You know what that meant? They all went on to do more profound things. Everybody who's going to lose a job because of AI in the next decade, not maybe that exact person, because they may be in a life cycle where they can't, but that person represented as an 18-year-old is going to do a different job. For example, let me give you one that is going to be a massive job. Prompt engineering. The ability to be good at asking AI questions is going to be a skill set. So for every kid that is going to be like, oh my God, I can't do Adobe design anymore. That's not a job. I remind that kid, first of all, I'm old enough to know when that wasn't a job either. You took the job of the people that used to do it on paper when I was a kid. So I think people get caught up in these things without realizing how the world has worked forever.
But how does that change, like with VaynerMedia, right?
It becomes a potential vulnerability.
So what's the balance between
putting my
people to manage this stuff?
Or do brands even want to work with agencies?
Do they?
I don't know. But I'm not scared of that. I'll put myself out of business before I let someone else do it. Meaning, I will adjust to the reality of the game. By the way, I can't cry about that. We've built one of the largest global independent agencies in the world by making videos and pictures and marketing and social media, and we've taken that money directly out of the Don Drapers of the world. Every dollar that VaynerMedia has is a dollar that Wieden & Kennedy, or Crispin Porter, or Ogilvy, or Leo Burnett, or mine, you know, Share or Starcom had. So if I'm taking from someone else, I can't be a hypocrite if something's coming along that might take from me. This goes back to the earlier energy. I don't think that I am entitled to benefit from entrepreneurship. I think I need to respect entrepreneurship and be a good entrepreneur, and then I will reap the benefits of it. It's actually my biggest problem with fake entrepreneurs that make a lot of money and then go use their money in politics to try to change laws to keep their money. I don't respect it because I think that they're a loser. I think that they used to be a young lion, but now they're an old lion. And instead of being honorable like Obi-Wan Kenobi and just letting yourself get killed, they go try to fucking do politics and change. The level of cynicism and judgment, and I don't have a lot of that in me, but there's something so romantic of pure entrepreneurship to me that I really get disappointed when I see people start from little or people that start with a base and build it big. And then when they're done being in the arena, because they don't have it anymore, they're tired. They didn't put in the energy that the young bucks are doing. They go try to change laws in America to benefit them. That's a fucking loser. I can promise you right now, that will never be a chapter in my career. If AI is destined to come and kill me, I will Obi-Wan Kenobi that shit.
I feel like you're never leaving the arena. There's no chance.
And by the way, I think that's right, comma. If I wake up one day at 81 and I'm like, you know what? Fuck it, I'm leaving the arena. This now has my attention, or this will bring me greater joy, then that's how I see it. Not let me go fucking be an old dude who's gonna use all my power and money to like make it good for me to continue to make money when I don't deserve it. You don't see that with athletes. Wayne Gretzky's still not playing hockey, right? The merit of the game is respected, and too many people in modern capitalism, like, you got more money because you figured it out. Like, the cynical, let me phrase, the counterpoint to what I'm saying, which I've heard from people that I've said this right to their fucking faces, no, that becomes the game. And I'm like, cool, if you think so. But that's bringing no value to anybody but you.
Okay, so we're not going to see, like, Senator.
You're not going to see, no, that's different. That's being a politician. You probably won't see that either. But what you definitely won't see is a Vayner super PAC that bans AI because I'm scared that it's going to fuck up VaynerMedia. That you will not see.
Will we see Vayner go public?
Probably not. I'm too focused on not having to worry about the short term. I think the biggest reason I will never be a public CEO is I have no interest in appeasing people that think it's interesting to judge businesses in every 90-day window.
It's also a pain in the ass.
Yeah, it's also stupid. Like when you're running a marathon, let me rephrase, that's not fair. It's stupid for someone like me who wants to do the game in perpetuity. If I'm playing in perpetuity, why would I succumb myself to something that is a short-term game? If you're a marathon runner, you don't do the 100-yard dash. So I think private is so fun. I get to have bad years. Last year wasn't a good year for Vayner. Meaning it was a great year, but like I should have made a lot more profit. But I just decided to go in for the jugular. And I'm investing like crazy, and I invested like crazy. And so we made a lot less profit last year than, let's say, the street would have wanted me to. And I have no interest, Nicole, to sit in front of fucking people and be like, all right, everybody, let me tell you why my stock is gonna go down this year. Because I'm building this forever, and I'm gonna hire more people and advance my best people. Like, do you know how crazy that is? Like, watching public CEOs pander to hedge funds or analysts who are fucking Excel jockeys on what they're gonna do for the next 90 days or this year. Like, business is so simple. You're either extracting out profit or you're investing back into your business. Like, I don't know how.
I feel like you and I, like, are old school. Like, this is what happens when your parents are immigrants.
Probably.
And it's like, I just believe at the end of the day, you run a profitable business. Like, period, the end. You make money.
Or, if you're really building a great business, like when everyone was razzing, like, I'd only bought a couple public stocks in my life. And one was Amazon 100 years ago. Because it was just very clear to me, like, Jeff Bezos was going for the jugular. He gave a fuck about customers, and he was reinvesting in his business. And they were shitting on him. Like, I would have CNBC in the background, and people like, you're not profitable, tell us why. Like, what? Like, what, how? You don't need a lot of brain power to understand they were going for the jugular. It's one thing to waste money. It's another thing that you're losing market share because someone's outflanking you. But there's just such clear indication that some people are going for the long term. And I think I would struggle as a public CEO. I don't think I'd be good.
I agree.
I'd be fired real fast. If I would be smart and probably not give the board any opportunity to fire me, but I wouldn't enjoy it. Because I might not give a fuck if my stock went from $52 to $3.09, but Dustin would, and that would be pressure on me. I'd feel, it would be hard for me to feel bad. Because, you know, people would be like,
people.
Yeah, because people. Like, so I just don't think I'd do well at it.
So speaking of Dustin, how often are you on your phone? Like, how often are you actually checking social media? Where are your boundaries?
Well, you know, it's funny, like, things ebb and flow. Because I'm so office-based and, like, very meetings-based right now, I'm not on my phone a lot. Believe it or not, because I'm so in meetings. I literally, Nicole, like, my normal Monday through Friday is something like 8 a.m. to 9 a.m., somewhere in that range, to minimally 7 p.m., straight booked in meetings every minute. And then I have dinner meetings, right? And so, like, you know, it's hard for me to get a lot of phone time in on that. But when I'm traveling, like, definitely more, but I'm checking social media for the piece, what I talked about in the book, PCSing, post creative strategy. I'm looking for sentiment of, I read the comments to the content I put out to help me inform what I'm gonna put out next, or where's their value, or what didn't I see that people like, or, you know, so I am spending time on it, but less right now. I'm really in meeting life.
Well, I really like how you talk about, you know, raising kids in this world and saying that they're not gonna avoid it. You just have to teach them self-esteem and confidence. For someone who didn't get self-esteem and confidence from her parents just asking for a friend, what would you say to those types of feelings of depression and anxiety around being social so much?
Well, that's incredibly normal. Like, there was people who were older than us that had massive anxiety watching Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And massive envy watching MTV Cribs. And the reason I brought up those two things is I'm trying to get the parents that are listening to realize envying people of wealth or status or perceived happiness is not a new phenomenon, right? And so I would say that makes sense. I think for everyone who's listening right now who has envy or anxiety or things of that nature, that's a natural human trait that's part of almost everybody's journey. And as someone who has the reverse, which is why I have such admiration for my parents and my circumstances, you know, I would tell you that the quicker you get into a place of just loving yourself regardless is how fast you're going to start being okay with it. And here's what I mean by that. I think the biggest issue in the world right now is that we put people on a pedestal that we don't know. And I'm one of those people. I get my emails and my DMs, and I'm very grateful. I'm flattered. But what I want to remind everybody, from me for damn sure, and anyone you could be thinking, I actually want everyone to, I don't know if I want you to close your eyes, but I'd like for everyone to really think about this. I mean, like in the room. I want you to think about who you admire that you don't know. Right? Like, real talk. Rihanna, LeBron, I don't know, right? Let's do a dramatic pause for a second. Think about the person. Good. do you know how many things they suck at? Do you realize that they, like, they have right this second a child, a brother, a sister, a parent that could sit with you for an hour and shit on that person so heavy for what they're not good at, what they don't do, what, like, this is human life. I think for the people that you're talking about, which is almost everyone who's listening, why are you putting someone else on a pedestal and shitting on yourself? Now, I know why. Back to the vulnerability and transparency you're leading on. The circumstances of one's life led to a place where that was part of the framework. I watched my, I mean, I knew my dad's mom very well, my grandma Esther. May she rest in peace. I love her with all my heart. But this was an extremely negative woman. Like, at a central casting from the Soviet Union. Like, everything you can think of. And so it's very obvious to me, watching my father, when I got to really know him in my late teens and then my entire 20s and 30s, where we spent all our time together, I understand why my dad is different than me. I had a mother who built me up, and he had a mother who tore him down. And we both ended up successful, because that's what happens. The extremes of both lead to success. Obviously, what I want for the world is for more people to get to success through happiness and joy than insecurity to prove to everyone. Right? When you come from that place, you know this intimately based on what you've shared. You're so driven to succeed to consciously or subconsciously show everyone, stick it to everyone. It comes from, it's funny, I brought up Star Wars already. It's the flight of the dark side versus the Force. They're actually very close. You can be both Darth Vader and Yoda. They're actually both very powerful. Deep insecurity and deep confidence, not ego. Ego is insecurity with makeup on. Deep actual confidence and content and deep insecurity both end up at the top. There's just one big difference. The first one can stay there. When you get to the top from deep insecurity, shit gets really gnarly fast. The reason we've seen so many people grow and crumble is because money and fame and success do not change you. They deeply expose you. And so one of the reasons a lot of my content changed 7 to 10 years ago was, ironically, books like the one I just wrote. I would put out such black and white, exactly what to do opportunities. And I would watch the world that at least was on social media at the time. And I would wonder why people weren't doing it or why they would stop and start. And then I had my epiphany probably in my late 30s, which was, oh, I'm in a good place where I can handle the criticism, the micro losing, the sustained discomfort. And all these people can't. Oh, why is that? And that got me on the journey of like, oh, fuck. Like, I got fortunate. Like, DNA and parenting and circumstance, perfect storm. This makes sense. But, you know, I think one of the things that people always find weird when they really get to know me is my great passion is my career. I love it. It's my game. I love working the way people love skiing or cooking or playing golf. Like, it's, or going on vacation. It is my favorite thing to do. I love it. But what I think stuns people as they get closer and closer to me is I don't get my validation from it. I don't give a fuck about it. I love it. It's my game, but it's not who I am. And I think I'm trying to figure out ways to put out information that might help people realize why that's good.
You talk a lot about your parents, you talk about your grandma. You don't talk a lot about your kids.
No.
You're a great dad, like I know in real life. But why is that?
I think too many parents are putting their kids on blast without their kids wanting it. I'm a very well-known person at this point in my life. I don't want to force my kids into notoriety if they don't want it. Period.
Some people think like, oh, I have to be so authentic and transparent and show all the things. Like, you don't show all the things.
I don't show shit. Right? I think that's unfair to children. Now, I jumped in real hard here. I do not judge others. I love talking about parenting in the macro. I hate talking about it in the micro. I am not saying that every parent that's doing that is wrong. They might be 100% right. I don't know their children. I know for me that it's very important that I don't do it for them. And so I think it's not understood yet, because we've never lived through an era where everyone has the potential to be known. And I think that there's a lot of children that will end up resenting their parents for putting them on blast like that. And there's other children that will learn so much from it, it'll be awesome. I just don't know the outcome of mine, and I'm not willing to take that risk.
Can we do a little game?
I'm always up for a game.
I'd love to do a bullish and bearish game.
Bullish and bearish, heard.
Yeah. Okay, Meta.
Bullish.
Reddit.
Bullish.
Alphabet.
Bullish.
Waymo.
I'm not educated enough to give an answer on that, to be honest.
NVIDIA.
I feel like, again, not educated. It feels like, I'm just not educated enough, but it definitely feels like it's so hyper big that I'm like, I feel like if I spend 10 hours educating myself, I'm like, oh, okay, this is not sustainable to be this crazy.
Disney.
Very bullish. And I know Disney gets dragged into politics a little bit, but I think intellectual property is one of the most underrated businesses of the future of VR and everything. I don't think people understand how big owning IP is gonna be.
Tesla.
Bullish.
Microsoft.
Very bullish. I've been very impressed with what they've done the last 5 years.
OpenAI.
I'm going with very general, like, I'm not saying their stock price or anything. Is that what you want me to do? Whatever I want. I'm bullish.
GPT. Amazon.
Very bullish.
Zoom.
Bullish.
Alibaba.
Bullish.
ByteDance. TikTok's kind of company.
Bullish.
Even though it might be banned?
A pimple in the ass of the overall thing.
Still create content?
Bullish.
Yeah. Okay, Coinbase.
Bullish.
Not a company, but NFTs.
Bullish, but I understand. So actually, this would be a good pause because I know that one probably caught people off guard given where the brand of NFTs are. Everything I just said bullish to is you've asked about very contemporary, front-facing, going-forward businesses, right? Like some of those people may have changes. I was thinking very heavily when you said those companies, who's running them right now? So, but every one of those companies is on the right side of history right now. The world is only going more teched out advancement. It's not going backwards, right? So, you know, what's really fascinating about that is if you're a legacy media company, you can only win if you make very smart decisions, right? Liberty Media, buying Formula One, you need to make that kind of level of brilliant decisions to stay ahead of the curve because your business models are getting crushed, right? Being a cable network, tough business right now. No more free money from bundled subscriptions. So far the ones you've talked about are all going in the right direction. They may not have the same stock value. They may have bumps in the road. They may get lapped. But they're all right now heading that way. NFTs is different. The reason I said that I'm bullish on it is because NFTs have just gone through the recalibration of short-term greed. Right? Just like internet stocks had to do that in the 90s. Late 90s internet stocks, pets.com was worth billions of dollars with zero sales. The market was right that the internet was going to be big. It was just everybody got ahead of their skis. The reason I said bullish on NFTs is I'm going to clip this in 20 years because there's going to be 5 to 10 NFT projects that are going to be the Jackson Pollock and Andy Warhol and Pokemon and Hello Kitty of this generation. I work every day feverishly to make sure VFriends is one of those things. I want it to be the Sesame Street meets Pokemon of this era. And I know right now, even though I don't know who she or he is, I don't know who they are. But I know for damn sure there are two artists right now making NFTs that in 20 years, everyone's gonna collect and they're gonna be the most sought after. What people got confused with NFTs, I don't know. And fuck, if I did, I promise you I'd be buying them. And you know what's cool about NFTs? It's on the blockchain. People would see that I'm buying them. So it's like a cool world, but I would say this. Where everyone has NFTs wrong is the following. NFTs are stuffed animals. NFT projects are Beanie Babies. So NFTs is a macro genre. And so everybody got caught up in the up and the down. But at the height of NFTs, I was making content saying 99% of these are going to zero. And I did it because I wanted to be, again, historically correct. And I wanted people to hear what I was saying about why I'm bullish on NFTs. But do I think NFTs as collectibles, just like trading cards? 99% of trading cards are worthless. Michael Jordan's rookie card is worth hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. 99% of trading cards are worthless, but Charizard, the best Pokemon from the first time, is worth tons of money. Sneakers. 99% of sneakers don't sell on StockX, but the 1%, watches. 99% of watches are not worth something in secondary market, but 1% is. And art. 99% of art that's made is not Rashid Johnson, it's not Jackson Pollock, it's not Monet. Same with NFTs. 99% of collectible NFTs will be worth zero, but the 1% for the next generation will be the collectible of choice because of the way digital will work, and that's why I'm bullish on it.
It'll be the Lafitte.
That's right. Thank you for that. I'm sad at myself and way to pick me up. 99% of wine is not collectible.
Right.
It's drank fucking within the year that it's made, and people drink it this weekend for Easter, right? At the time of this recording. But 1% of wine is collectible, and that's where people got the NFT thing wrong. But it's really interesting what you asked. I love having a mix of bullish and bearish, but I struggle to not be excited about the companies that are at the forefront of technology. Most of the companies you just mentioned have such an obnoxious advantage on AI. And then I'm even scared a little bit back to government involvement, because people are so scared of AI. A lot of these biggest tech companies might really get lucky where the government's gonna pass certain laws around AI, and they're gonna be sitting there nice and pretty because they're gonna be the ones that control it, not the open market. I'm concerned about that.
So let's drink about it.
Let's drink about it. let's drink our concerns away.
Let's drink our AI away. Okay, so I heard that Barolo is your favorite.
Barolo, I love Barolo.
Burgundy.
Yes.
So I have this bottle. I don't know if it's important or fancy.
It's important and fancy and good. I'm very impressed. Alessandro is a really good producer. It's a single vineyard.
The whole team.
I love this. It's a single vineyard Barolo. It's from 18.
I don't know if this is the right glass. I get a little anxiety. No. About.
So first of all, I know I'm not to the mic. I'm sorry, but let's talk about glass. Are there ideal glasses? Yes, because they work well with the oxygen that needs to come in. But I just want everyone to hear this. I have drank plenty of very expensive wine in my life out of a plastic cup, let alone the perfect glass. Like the one thing I've really hated my whole life about wine is we intimidate people with it. It's another thing we use to make people feel insecure, right? So like all you need to know about wine is, do you like it? That's really the actual
Dustin?
Truth.
Yeah?
Oh, Dustin likes wine.
Yes. For sure.
All of a sudden everyone's coming out of the woodworks. The good wine gets poured.
Sounds good. All right, so we're gonna play a game of financial never have I ever.
Okay, remind me how I have to play this. Never have I ever.
If you have done something.
Drink if I've done it.
Yes.
Got it.
Okay. Never have I ever maxed out a credit card.
Drink if I have done it.
Never have I ever split the check on a first date.
Never? Drink if I've done it. Split the check on a first date? Never. No
You're
way.
Such a bench. Leased a car.
Leased a car? Yeah. If I've leased a car.
Yeah.
Only.
That's his lying deal. Fought with a significant other about money.
Have I fought with my dad? So you mean like a spouse or like a family member? Significant other? Oh, definitely not. No.
Signed a prenup.
If I've signed a prenup, I have to drink. I have to drink.
Romantic. Gambled in Vegas.
Oh yeah. Here's my most frivolous money thing. Back to me not being very attached to money. As a matter of fact, I used Las Vegas from 21 to 26. Big shout out to my great buddy Rob Muse. I worked all the time as a kid. The only thing I really did for myself was go to Jet Games on Sundays, which really worked with the store schedule. But I would always take one weekend a year and go to Vegas at 22, 23, 24, 25 with Rob Muse. And I was so sure of where I was going professionally, and I was so into gambling at the time. One time I lost like 40% of all my savings in a weekend. It was only like 20, it was a lot of money at the time, but like and then I lost my love for gambling. Something happened where I couldn't win enough to get excited, but I could lose enough to be upset. I really haven't truly gambled for about 10 years now.
Yeah, this is not for money, it's for the Jets, this color for you.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I used to be willing to pay for the entertainment. I viewed it as a deposit. I'm gonna go to Vegas, I'm gonna lose $7,000, and that's gonna be awesome, that's a vacation. Then it just changed and I haven't been there. But anyway, go ahead.
Spent $1,000 on a bottle of wine.
If I've done it, yes.
I think I have. It's good wine.
It's good wine.
Overdrafted.
My money? No. I'm an immigrant. We don't fuck with that. My dad didn't even accept. Forget about him having a credit card. This is so fucking insane. You want to talk about being propaganda?
Sasha
not only did not have a credit card, like when normal people did in the early 90s, our store, when I started working at Shoppers Discount Liquors, did not accept credit cards.
Wow.
Cash, check.
And now do they accept credit cards?
Yes, I mean the world, you know, I was like, Dad, like, because I would be at the register and people would like leave. This was like 1993. People would like leave this, they would only have a credit card even then. They would like leave. Remember checks?
Never have I ever disputed a charge on a credit card.
If I've disputed a charge on credit card, I got a drink. This is something that's gonna make everybody, I wanna be transparent on this podcast. I'm not gonna drink, but I view this as a weakness of mine. This is because I don't look at my credit card statements my whole life. I'm sure I've been charged for shit. Listen, here's the thing on that. I'm so offense, bad at defense. Like, to your point, that's, I preface it by like, please, if you're watching, that's not a cool, I'm not cool. That's wrong. But I did it the majority of my life, and then I got to a level of wealth where I have my financial team around me, and they're doing it for me, so I'm good, but I've never done it.
Never have I ever had buyer's remorse on a big purchase. Never have I ever invested in a company that went bankrupt.
The majority of the companies I invested in went bankrupt.
Never have I ever invested in a company that became a unicorn.
Mm. So if I've done it.
Yeah, drink.
Drink, so I get to drink of this one.
Never have I ever felt like I had enough.
If I felt like I had enough, then I drink. Yeah. Oh, I can drink the whole bottle. This is the best part about how my life works. I am uncomfortably ambitious, comma.
And also,
I have always been satisfied. It's really cool. It is, you know, Nicole, it's funny. It just really hit me in my chest. Like, I really do feel guilt of how lucky I am of how I'm wired. And I do believe most of what Gary Vee is me trying to give back out of some way to like deal with the fact that it really broke for me. And I don't mean financially. You met me when I was far from what I am now, and you remember how lucky and happy I was. And I knew people, there's so many people in my life that knew me 10 years before that and 10 years before that. It's always been there. I've always been deeply satisfied while equally obnoxiously hungry. And that's a great place, you know?
L'chaim.
Hey everybody, I wanted to say that a new book is coming, a follow-up to Jab, 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 Right Hook, originally called Jab, 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 Left Hook, but I finally captured what I've been doing for the last 20 years as an entrepreneur, as a creator and influencer, as an operator of a marketing company that works with Fortune 5,500 companies, and really the punchline of what I'm seeing in society, which is day trading attention, how to actually build brand and sales in the new social media world. I'm really proud of this book. When I read it, and some of you follow my social enough to see the clips, when I read it in studio, it got so deep, it goes so detailed. It goes macro and micro, as I like to roll. And so if you've not picked up a copy yet, go to GaryVee.com/DTA, which stands for day trading attention. I have a feeling that this book, much like Jab, 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 Right Hook, literally got an email, they just read it, it's 10 years ago. The updated version of the marketing manual for your marketing team. Definitely if you have a social media person that runs your stuff, you need to get a book for them. And definitely the marketers in Fortune 500 for your staff and the entrepreneurs and creators and influencers who are trying to build something for themselves. So proud of it. Hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed putting it together. The manual that we are going to give to everybody when they join VaynerMedia to read, and hopefully the manual to the modern marketing world, and especially social media first world. Day trading attention out this May 2024. Pre-order your copy now.